But a lot of companies are reluctant to invest in their people still, despite everything that we know how beneficial it is, just because it's still seen as a cost on the balance sheet rather than actual an investment.
You've just heard Karen Reiter, SVP Sustainability and ESG at the Adecco Group, speaking about sustainability and the green transition. Welcome back to Future of Work Conversations, a podcast all about the intersection of human talent and leadership in the shifting world of work. In this episode, Ms. Reiter speaks with Magali Anderson, Chief Sustainability and Innovation Officer at Holcim, about sustainability and human capital strategies, the importance of upskilling in a business success, and how leaders can harness their workers and motivate them in the green transition. Let's dive in.
Hi, Magali. Thank you so much for being with us today. So in prior such conversation, we've taken a little bit of a deeper look at the world of work and how it's changing, and particularly the impact it has on the human resources function. Today, we want to take a slightly different focus and look at the interrelationship between sustainability strategy and the human capital strategy. So I'm quite excited to have you with us. You certainly have a very strong reputation in the sustainability field, but I think it would be really interesting if you could just give a little bit of an introduction to yourself to a broader audience.
Sure. Hi, Karen, and very happy to be here to discuss a very important topic. I am Magali Anderson. I'm the Chief Sustainability and Innovation Officer of Holcim. Holcim is the biggest building material company in the world. And I've been in that role for about 3 years. I'm an engineer by trade. And prior to that, I spent the majority of my career working, in fact, in the oil and gas industry and working in mainly either technical roles or operational roles. I was in charge of countries. I was in charge of P&L. So I have quite a very diverse background before reaching the world of sustainability and innovation about 2 years ago.
Very interesting. We'll talk a little bit about the inclusion and diversity part a little bit later on. But first, as part of your role, you've been able to set some really ambitious net zero commitments for the organization to really look at how you can rapidly and as well as really radically decarbonize your industry. But for that, to achieve that, you can't just only look at investments in R&D and new infrastructure, but you also will need to look at the linkages with your human capital strategies. So how do you ensure that you have the right skills, expertise, and talent within your organization to make that transition happen?
Well, in fact, the majority of the work is going to happen at the level of the cement plant. It's really how do we make the new chemistry of cement for the future? So these people already exist. These people with the right skills and knowledge already exist. Now, did they have the right focus in the past would be more the question. So it's more a question of using what they already know and train them properly and get them to buying the transformation and having a very active role in it, more than actually new skills. Now, there are new skills needed in some other departments, such as Plant of Tomorrow, which also contributes. But the pure decarbonization, the vast majority of the technical skills required, we actually already have it.
Okay. I mean, you're speaking, or you're touching on something very interesting, right, that you need to bring the whole organization along on this transformation journey. This is not just your team that drives it, but it's everybody within the organization. How do you bring them along that they don't feel overwhelmed with this change, that they're afraid for their jobs or what it might mean? How do you...
It was actually not that difficult. I think people were in demand of it. The majority of people have children, and children who are reaching teenage age, you know, little Greta Thunberg at different levels of growth. But they also hear people around them. They hear the news that they're working for this sector that is emitting so much CO2. And most people are not happy about that. Most people are very proud to work for a company that is trying to do something for the planet and the people. I don't know anybody who goes to work in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to destroy the planet a bit more today. That does not exist. Yeah. So I think inside them, they actually wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. And when we came out with the pledge, it was incredible. It was actually almost overwhelming, the positive answer we got from the entire organization, people sending emails, because we gave them a new purpose and we gave them a new speech to go home with, to be saying, instead of saying, When someone tells them, oh, you are working for a company that emits a lot of CO2, they said, no, I'm working for a company that is transforming the way we built to make the world better. So overall, I think we really got a lot of positive answers from these people who, because we were giving them the answers they needed.
And I think that is the key part, because what I see to some extent within our own organization, but also others, is more of that action readiness gap. I think, as you say, people really want to be engaged. They want to bring their own values to work. They want to connect to it, but they don't know how. They don't know how they can contribute to the work that you are doing, to the net zero targets or targets within the human rights space. So it's how do we enable them and empower them to connect with it. So I think you've done a fantastic job in getting there. So maybe this, can you share a learning from that?
Well, it goes from the top to the bottom and from the bottom to the top. So what's important is a tone from the top. And I think we clearly got it. We got it from Jan, we got it from the Exco, we got it from everyone else. But it also means that we give the right objectives. And that's why I quite often say that my best friend is a CFO, who happened to also be a lady. I often say that because it was very important to align the objective. You don't want the operation people to have to choose between Geraldine and Magali. Do I fulfill Geraldine's objective or Magali's objective? Because that's unfair. That's an impossible choice. So what was super important was to align that. So that's from the top. From the bottom, it was really people want to act. I truly believe people want to act. So it was declining the strategy in such a way that everyone knew what they had to do. And that required a lot of work. So after we finished the pledge, we engaged into a big roadmap work where we engaged a lot of people in each country. And we did a huge amount of communication, training, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really to define for everybody what to do. So that was, again, on the technical side. But we launched other things. So we just launched very recently something called Office Goes Green. And it's about the offices. So, for example, here there's no more plastic bottles in our offices. Mm-hmm. In Zug, there haven't been any plastic bottles for a long time now. But we want to engage because we realized that the technical transformation actually was only touching a relatively small number of people. Okay. And we wanted to engage much more. So with initiative like Office Goes Green, you now engage every office person. Mm-hmm. With the Scope 3, you engage every procurement person. So we've been, some of the activities we did was really truly to engage everyone because everyone wants to participate.
Oh. And I think this is a perfect example, right? How you make it tangible for everyone and show them that they can contribute to it as well. It's not just somebody who has sustainability in their title, but it's irrespective of where you sit in the organization, you can contribute to it.
Absolutely.
Maybe let's take a slightly different perspective. I heard you talk about, you know, the need to be not just carbon positive, but also nature positive. And I know that you've done quite a bit of work also in terms of human rights, strengthening your approach there. I think end of last year, you launched a new policy and a new framework around it. Can you maybe share a little bit more about how are you balancing all the work that you're doing to become nature positive, that it doesn't have a detrimental impact on the people in the communities that you work, for example, because they're now losing their livelihoods because you're transitioning out of certain areas?
I think the only way to do it is to have it inside your thinking, inside your strategy. So when you develop your strategy, we have the way we develop strategy in my team is, I don't know if everyone does that, but the way we do it is a bit particular where everyone works together. Mm-hmm. So if we are working on the nature strategy, the climate guy is here, the human rights lady is here, everyone is here. So they give their opinion so that we don't forget any angles, so that we do something that works for both people and planet. But in the case of the nature strategy, it was actually pretty easy because our nature strategy is in several folds. One of them is to rehabilitate our quarries. Mm-hmm. So when we have a quarry which is coming to an end of life and we rehabilitate it, we do a transformative rehabilitation where we try to bring back native species, native animals. That should be good for the people, right? Mm-hmm. To bring back all the species that were there before we started the quarry. Or that sometimes we're not there because sometimes it was farmland and sometimes they had disappeared. So our objective is actually to bring it better ecosystem than the one we took at originally. But the other part of the strategy is to say, how do we reconcile nature and city? Mm-hmm. So it's to go beyond the fence of our own activities and our own impact and saying, okay, so we're going to build a lot of cities. We're going to build much more with the urbanization trend, and we need to do that in a better way. So, for example, we have a concrete called Hydromedia, and it allows to do urban forest. So it allows in the streets to plant trees, okay. And you don't have to choose anymore between concrete and trees. It's usually the problem, right? It's nice to have trees, but you still need to have pathway for people to walk on. So Hydromedia not only allows to plant trees in the streets, but because it's porous, the water goes through, it absorbs 500 liters of water per square meter per second. So in case of big flooding event, it will evacuate it much quicker. That's a typical example where you are fighting the urban heat island effect, which I think for people who didn't know what that means, they are discovering it right today in Europe, as it's more than 30 here in Zug today.
Unbelievable.
So you are tackling a lot of things that actually are very good for the people, not just for the nature. So it should go together. If it doesn't go together, that means you have looked at it wrongly.
No, I think you're right. I think that's the thing, right? How do we become humanity positive? That is both that's for the nature, one. Right?
Can I use it?
Of course.
I love it. Humanity positive, that's great.
No. Yeah, because in the end, right, what one of the challenges today is now that we increasingly talk about ESG, is that people look at it in isolation, right? It's the E, it's the S. But you just said it as well, right? We need to look at it like the two parts of a helix, like DNA, and what are the different sides of it that it really becomes a just transition or humanity positive in the end. Do you think, you now talked a lot about innovation that is happening, that you see also a lot of new jobs being created through that work, where a lot of upskilling and reskilling needs to happen as well, and companies need to invest more in that?
In the case of Holcim, the majority of the work, we can do it with our current people.
Okay.
Because it's really doing cement slightly different, but the process working in the cement plant, etc., remain more or less the same. Now, when we go to the construction site, this is where you will certainly start having upscalings. For example, if we move to 3D printing, we are doing 3D printing in Africa. We did 3D printing in Malawi, where we printed the first school. There's a societal gap there of about 40,000 school in Malawi, and we could print the walls in 18 hours. So we could really close that gap much quicker. So what we have done is we have trained people to use a 3D printer instead of laying bricks, but we are also making the inks. The ink is the concrete locally now. So there is a bit of upskilling when we look at how we built, but on the making on cement and concrete, it's not hugely different to today. We have an initiative called Plant of Tomorrow, which will require a bit of upskilling. But I would say, if I was looking in terms of percentage of our total population, it's not that significant.
Okay, because that is what we see in other industries, right, that have such a huge need to upskill and reskill because there's so many skills gaps and bottlenecks that they don't know how to address it. But a lot of companies are reluctant to invest in their people still, despite everything that we know how beneficial it is, just because it's still seen as a cost on the balance sheet rather than actual an investment. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on that. Speaking of upskilling, I just heard before that you have a program called Women on Wheels that was looking at bringing more women into the labor force. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's one of my, I have a lot of favorite topics, but it's what I really, truly love a lot. So Women on Wheels is about women truck drivers.
Okay.
And for example, in France, less than 4% of the truck drivers are female. And there is absolutely no reason for it. Because the new technology with the trucks, everybody can drive them. You don't need to be Superman with big, big muscles to drive them. But also, the women are actually safer drivers. I know not everyone agrees with that, but statistics say that. They are less aggressive, which means they use much less fuel. Nowadays, with the crisis of fuel, people are learning how to use less fuel while driving. Well, women usually are better at that. And majority of the trips, you go home the same evening. It's not that many where you have to sleep outside, which could be a problem for a woman if there is no female facilities where she would be stopping. So you look at all of this and say, so why no more women? Then the only reason why there is no more women is purely cultural. There's absolutely no other reason whatsoever. So the only way to fight that is to go out, and we had an academy in Nigeria where 54 women got graduated as truck drivers. We did another one in Kenya. So we are now launching that worldwide. So very exciting project.
Maybe that's my next career step, becoming a truck driver.
Why not? There is a huge shortage of talents.
Yeah. We know that we also see it with crane drivers. There's also a huge shortage there.
The shortage of talents, there's a huge talent pool that is untapped.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I just think we can do so much there.
Do you feel enough is being done? And if not, what do you think needs to change for us to be able to bring more women or underrepresented talent into the labor market?
Clearly not enough is done. It's absolutely. It's not one size fits all. And how many hours do we have in front of us here? You know, I write a blog just about that, right? About women in the industry. And there's a lot of articles. Yeah. No, I think in general, it's several things. It's, one is change the image. Mm-hmm. Women need to understand they can do that job. Mm-hmm. So if you have advertising where you only see big, strong men on the picture, might not work. Mm-hmm. So change the image, change the wording of your job ads, where it's clearly written that it's addressing to both. Reach out to women. Go to places where you would not typically go to find them. And, you know, use role models. I always tell my organization, I'm more than happy to go to universities to explain that you can work in the cement industry as a woman. It's a great place to be. Mm-hmm. And, of course, work in your own organization to try as much as possible to kill all the bias and, of course, all the famous ordinary sexism, which, unfortunately, still continues to happen way too much.
Yeah, very true. And, I mean, you as chief innovation officer, also as part of your role, right? You rely on diverse perspectives as well in order to drive it. So you need to be multidisciplinary and multifaceted, whether it is around gender, but also different perspectives and experiences. Yeah. Right? And I think that's where we sometimes are still too single focused from a diversity perspective.
Now, the diversity of thinking is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And statistics show that diverse innovation teams enough, way better than non-diverse, and it makes total sense. And that's why my team is always made of, you know, very diverse people. I have a person coming from an NGO. I have different nationalities, different backgrounds. It's extremely important to have all the different opinion and views, and that's the reason why I was telling you when we do strategy work, I bring everyone together so everyone give their own angle independently of the actual job.
I mean, and that's such an important point, right? Because sometimes we're also biased, or we come with our own backgrounds and we think that is the right way to do, rather than putting ourselves in the shoes of others and thinking about, okay, how do we solve for them rather than just from my perspective?
No, absolutely. We are all guilty of it.
So much learning that still needs to happen, right? Maybe just one last question around, what do you think would be the biggest change or biggest changes? I'll leave it to you whether you can whittle it down to one thing that businesses or governments must do to really ensure that humanity positive future for everyone. What do you feel is currently missing that stops us from really accelerating much faster?
The entire system. Is that a good answer? No, it's what is incentivizing people is important. So I think the reason I could bring some of the changes is because either have a strong operational background and not so much an expert of sustainability, even though I have, of course, experts in my team who are superheroes. I understand what incentivizes people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned earlier how with the CFO we aligned the objective. I forgot to say something. We gave a long-term incentive bonus linked to that to all our senior leaders. Yeah. Sounds like a bit of a detail, but you just need to understand what incentivizes people. Yeah. And what incentivizes people, bonus helps, because bonus is a way for a company to make the priority, but also when you can align your values, what you want to do with what the business wants. And that's why I think the true transformation is when you change the business model of the company. In the case of Holcim, you might have seen that slogan where we say we want to build more with less. So it's a bit surprising, right? We are a cement, concrete company, building material, And we're saying, buy less of our material to do the same object. But it's really how we should transform. And to do that, we need to be incentivized to sell less. So we need to be incentivized to do the same object with less material. So the way the business looks at it has to be different. And you're talking about skill transformation. There's one I didn't talk about. It's a marketing and sales team. And we are working very closely together to have people who can have that discussion without the prescriptors and saying, why don't we buy differently? Instead of concrete being a commodity, why don't we look at the performance and you buy the performance of a product and you don't buy the quantity of the product.
That's an interesting perspective.
Quite a shift. Yeah. So I think the biggest change that needs to happen is find the right incentive at every single level. And that incentive should push for better humanity and not push just for more money.
Yeah. It's a very fair point, right? It's some of the motivation is intrinsic, as you said before, right? It's we want to do good. Nobody goes up in the morning and says, let me destroy the planet. But I think it's then also how do we need to change our systems to be able to account for that? So are you then more optimistic about the future that we're really able to transition to a green economy?
Depends on the days. So I don't wake up every day super optimistic, but overall quite. And quite because just when I see the changes that have happened the last 3-4 years, in the speech, at the COP, everywhere, at the WEF, it's happening. Is it happening fast enough? Is it going to be without hurdle? Certainly not. So that's when I am less optimistic. But it is now so central of every discussion that's happening anywhere that I remain very positive for the future.
And you're certainly setting an amazing example for many others. I really appreciate you sharing some of your insights. Hopefully that inspired some others to follow suit, suit as well, so that we can really achieve this. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Future of Work Conversations. For more information about the Adecco Group and the latest insights on the world of work, head to our website at www.theadeccogroup.com. Did you like the episode? Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to explore, please email us at futureofwork@adeccogroup.com. Don't worry, we won't spam you. Until next time, thanks for listening.